Recording
This
in
meeting is
progress.
being. All right.
Okay,
So
yeah.
we're live.
We are live. Hello, everybody. This is Anaf and Kanaz. Good to be with you today.
Howdy. This is afternoon over here. I think it's morning on your end, good sir. So I'm doing well. How about yourself?
We're doing well. Rainy morning in New Jersey, but I'm always happy to be here at the podcast. Hello, everybody. And so you were talking, when we were talking before the chat started, about the role sub-state actors are playing, and you were saying it's kind of gloomy and despairing, and I know doom being your trademark, but I mean, I think you're right. That's something really important to talk about. We've reached a state where an Iron Dome and a top-notch security system can't really stop a bunch of people with rifles, dirt bikes, and paragliders.
And we can actually on this subject, good sir, what we can do is we can actually just point to contemporary events. I think yesterday the concert hall at Moscow got attacked, right? And just to give everyone an idea of what happened, this is a giant place, right? You're talking about max seating capacity of 6,200, right? This place got infiltrated by five dudes with basically what? You've got some rifles, you've got explosives. I think they set fire to the place, right? When I was getting news of the place, my immediate thought was, okay, so they're going to lure in the Russian Special Forces, FSB, and these types of people, and they're just gonna detonate the building. And that's how you kill thousands of people. And that's how you basically do a 9/11 style attack on Russia, right? That was my worst fear, as the because you know how these things are, right? When the reports start coming in, right? Unless you're on the ground in the vicinity, you have no idea what's going on, right? You're like, okay, what do I believe? Like, this Telegram channel says this, Telegram channel says that. So I have no clue what was going on, right? But no, there's definitely American fingerprints on this thing. Obviously, I can't say with 1,000% certainty that the Americans did it, but the way in which,
I
like
mean,
on
the
March 7th.
Americans did it. You can't say it for certain, but I mean, the Americans were certainly involved in that when they said ISIS. You mean, the American-Israel Joint Project happened to be involved in this. Curious. I
No,
mean,
but what I was gonna say was no, that's all true. But what I was gonna say was that on March 7th, their embassy had that notice go out, which is like avoid concerts and crowded venues for the next 48 hours. Now, I was watching Larry Johnson, the ex-CIA guy, and he was doing some interviews on all the YouTube shows, and he basically said something interesting. He said that look, the only time a person sends that out, right? And he's working intelligence, so he knows his stuff, right? So he basically said, look, the only time you send out a memo like that is if you have credible intelligence that something big's about to happen and you don't have the human resources to stop it. So you just tell everyone, okay, guys, it's gonna go down in 48 hours and we can't stop it, basically, right? So yeah, no, like you said, sir, the American fingerprints are all over the place. But really what this shows is that in the 21st century, small is the new big. And what I mean by that is, in the 20th century, right, half of it was really focused on nuclear warfare and how we're all going to kill each other and how the first strike means the second strike and then everyone dies, right? And nobody ever thought about the following question, which is as follows: what if the first strike is a suitcase nuke, right, with a yield of 2 to 0.2 kilotons or something small like that, right? So not quite at the level of a actual nuclear strike, but something so small that number one, your nuclear deterrent and the use of it would not be justified, and number two, you have no target to hit back at, because if you're dealing with a sub-state actor, this guy does not have a country, right? So what do you do then? What do you do then? Like, do you just like sit there, get angry at it, and be like, yeah, we'll do something about it, but oh, by the way, yeah, no,
We're
you're not
running
going
into
to, because,
this with Ansarallah. I mean,
yeah,
that's like, who are
precisely,
we going to,
precisely.
what army are we going to shoot at? We ran into this with Afghanistan. We have to break the army. Well, which army is that? It's an area the size of Texas that's spread out with mostly mountains and like a lot of farm, like a lot of farms that we don't know exactly how many. We don't know exactly where they all live. And the more we push,
Precisely, yeah.
it's like we're stuck in that. Yemen is going to be like Afghanistan with more weapons if we actually manage to be stupid enough to try to get ourselves involved in a land war there.
And for those of the audience who don't know the geography, Yemen has a west and it's got a western part and it's got a eastern part. The eastern part is relatively flat. It's got valleys and stuff. You can kind of do some maneuver, right? But the western part, and especially the northern western tip of Yemen, is basically all mountain fortress. It's basically a giant mountain fortress, right? And that's where actually 80% of the population lives. 80% of the population centers are in there. And the mountain fortress is so significant that the British, I believe, in the 1960s, when they were sieging the place, they had to run away. They literally had to run away. I think it was called the Siege of Sana'a or one of these battles, right? Where they had all this high-tech stuff, but really it's all for nothing because there's all just this mountainous terrain everywhere. You can't really get any maneuver. You can't even land properly, right? Because amphibious landings are one thing, but try doing an amphibious landing on mountainous terrain. That's like double the difficulty, right? So, no, the Americans are basically stuck in a trap. They can't do anything. The ships that they have, the carriers that they have, it's like 50, 60, 70-year-old frames. And really, when you move those things around, they're just sitting ducks and targets for all these like cheap missiles. And the only reason Ansarallah have not really shot down carriers and stuff yet is because they don't want to go on a full-scale war against the Americans. Their objective, their military objective, is to lift the blockade on the Palestinians, right? And so they wish to get to that objective without triggering this massive war, right? Because the thing is, and people don't understand that sub-state actors are intelligent actors, right? They're not this like, oh, we fight because we want the white blonde Western women and we just can't help ourselves and we want to basically mate with them. That's not what's going on here, folks. All right. These are intelligent people. They know what they're doing, right? That they're not like driven by these hedonistic, weird fetishes or whatever, right? Obviously, they like girls. Every guy's like girls. That's
Yeah,
just
most
normal,
do.
right?
I mean,
But
yes.
like this idea that, oh, Yemen's just doing this just 'cause, or like, that's just what people over there do, that's just silly, right?
They're just doing it
So,
because they hate our freedom. The fact that
exactly,
we're
yeah.
free, the fact that we're giving money to like a crim what's an international criminal event at this point in Gaza. The fact that we're supporting that has nothing to do with the fact that the Yemenites are really angry with us. That's just an excuse. But yeah, I mean, I think the problem is they've got, you've got a $100 Gould rifle, you've got drones that cost like 20,000. We've got missiles that'll cost $1 million to knock that $20,000 missile, that $20,000 drone down. That's, we can't. And we can't replace our missiles as fast as they can replace our drones. That's just, we have a big army set up for a big international war. We didn't understand it was going to be a big international guerrilla war with a bunch of small hot spots all over the place.
And it's actually much worse than that because for some of the keystone missiles that the Americans have, such as the Tomahawk, for example, Malcolm Ciuna, the wonderful commentator on Twitter and a couple of these other places like Compact Magazine, I think I already mentioned it, but he was saying that his sources tell him that the Americans have less than 4,000 Tomahawks left, right? And the reason they can't replenish them is because the workforce that used to do that and the factories that used to do that, well, guess what happened to them, right? When China entered the World Trade Organization and America's industries went bust, those guys became unemployed. And so they've been unemployed, at least in this particular sector, for the past few decades or so. So you can't just be like, hey, bro, you were employed in this like 30 years ago. We're going to rehire you and we're going to retrain you to remember all this stuff. And the guy's like, F you, man. I've been doing my other job here or I've been unemployed or whatever, right? But I don't want to go
Yeah.
back to you. Like,
I mean,
that's
it's
basically
just
that.
that's
That's
our
the situation.
problem in the United States. Getting people don't understand, we need to rebuild the manufacturing sector. It's not like, we need to get the auto industry back up. I'll have that fa can you have that factory back up by Tuesday? I mean, it's like it's not, it takes a long time to get to put these things back running again. We gutted our defense industry. We wound up focusing on technological Buck Rogers shit that really impressed, which really impressed generals, but which doesn't really work in the field because the rules, the engineering rule of complexity. Yeah, you've got super elite technology, and if one little semiconductor blows out in your elite technology, you have a very big paperweight.
100%, 100%. That's the situation. And the issue is that nobody seems to understand this. And like you said, good sir, they think like, oh, Tuesday or Wednesday morning, yeah, I just make the call. The guy just show. It's basically like the DoorDash mentality. It's basically a DoorDash mentality. It's like, I'm just gonna pick up the phone, I'm gonna call, and the food's gonna be here. It's the same thing. It's like, I'm just gonna call in the strike, the giant aircraft carrier battle group's gonna show up, and they're gonna do their thing, and they're gonna get out. Like, Americans have this fantasy about their military capabilities, which just isn't true, right? And like you were saying, the manufacturing is not there, the aircraft is not there, and actually, because they don't make a lot of the stuff anymore, right? Whether it's the Tomahawks, like there's no indigenous capacity to build Tomahawks anymore. The same is actually true for most of the jets, right? Like, I believe the F-15s and the F-16s, like these are what, 1970s, 1960s? That's when they
Yeah,
were
the
originally built.
F-35 is nicknamed the Penguin by people that fly it. That's not
Yeah.
really a definition of like, no, the F-35 is essentially like a huge money suck. The decent planes we've got are 70s era technology.
Yeah. And the worst thing is, right, it's 17 eras technology, but what actually happens is when they tell you, oh, we've upgraded it, or oh, we've refurbished it, right? And I think Philip Filkington, he's a buddy of Malcolm Chiune, but he's like a macroeconomist by trade, but he's into these types of subjects, right? And he was basically telling his buddy that what they actually do is that they don't have a factory. What they have is like they have like a dock or a hangar where they send the jet to. And then over there, they gut out the insides, right? Because, like, this is 1970s frame, right? Back then, the computers were very, very poor, right? So what you do is you gut out the outside, the inside, rather, and then you put in the new electronics that you kind of have from the 2020s or what have you, right? So basically, the way you imagine it is, let's say you had, like, I don't know, 1960s Mustang or something, right? And you take it to the auto shop, and the auto shop's like, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna take out all the electronics from this vehicle, which it doesn't exist because back then, electronics was not a thing in vehicles. And we're gonna put in these computers and these touch screens that is used in Tesla, right? We're gonna use like Tesla touch screen and these electronics, right? After we gut out the 1960s interior. That's literally 90% of the American military right now. You've got that nice looking exterior. And the interior is like a Frankenstein monster, right? And people expect me to believe that this is a formidable military. Like, give me a break, folks. Give me a break. Like, it's so embarrassing, right? When you actually know these things and when you actually realize that the DoorDash mentality is completely bogus, you actually feel sorry for the Americans. Like, you really do. Because they're walking into this disaster, which is completely unsalvageable, right? It's completely unsalvageable because what are you going to do, right? Are you going to use like something else? Well, you don't have something else. You don't have indigenous
We
production anymore.
have to do, and it's hard to like people, it's a hard thing to admit, but what we have to do is begin the peaceful unwinding of the global American empire. It's really clear we are overextended. We got our noses into places where we can trigger, I mean, a US-China war, a US-Russia war, or a US-Iran war would be a bloodbath, and there's no guarantee the Americans would come out of it on top. And
Precisely,
now
precisely.
a war that involved, because now add on to that, as soon as one of those wars start, the other two are likely to join in. And we will lose. We can't win a three-front war. We won a two-front war in World War II because we were able to pump up our factories. We don't have that capacity. We also, pumping up a factory to make mechanical stuff is challenging. Pumping up a factory to make electronics is really challenging. Pumping up a factory to make electronic chips is super challenging.
Yeah, exactly. And with regard to World War II, right, you could argue that America was in the best situation for that, in the sense that after the Great Depression, right, you had all this factory, all these factories all over the place, deserted and whatnot, right? But once you went on the war footing, you could basically pump up the employment again, right? So you had all this, right? But you don't have that over here anymore. You don't have like this workforce ready to be used, right? So, hey guys, it's wartime. Get back to work. Go and become like a dude at the manufacturing sector, right? That sector does not exist, right? 80% of Americans work in the service sector, right? And the remaining 20% or so, I think it's less than 10% now, who work in manufacturing, or maybe it's slightly higher than that. I forget my exact numbers, but it's not going to happen, right? There's many people who are, shall we say, semi-skilled workers, and they are from across the border. They're going to be like, F this. I'm not going to, I don't want to be in a country that's in a war footing. I'm just going to head back to Mexico or whatever, right? So they'll try to leave. And then there'll be people who are like super happy about the war because, finally their DoorDash Modern Warfare 2 fantasies are going to come to, are going to become reality. And then it's going to be like they realize, oh shit, they're going to draft me, or they're going to do XYZ to me. So they'll try to leave the country as well. So it's not the same population, right? And it's not the same population. It's not the same family unit, right? During the Great Depression, one of the reasons why so many American families, even though they went through all that hardship and distress and turmoil, at least they knew how to grow their own food. At least they knew how to salvage stuff, right? This is not true for most Americans today. Most of them live in these big cities, these posh urban places, where they've got multiple security guards. For the richer ones, I'm talking about the richer ones now, but they've got multiple security guards, right? They assume that when you go to the grocery store, the bananas are going to be there, and the kiwis are going to be on the other side, and then there's going to be some apples and so on and so forth, right? You take away all of that, what are they? They don't have anything. It's basically, it's very tragic, but they are not going to make it, right? And good sir, you were talking about a tree front war. Let's just imagine for a second the, what do you call it, the least worst case scenario, right? Let's say, I don't know, they go to war with Iran. And for whatever reason, you know what? Russia and China says, yeah, we're going to help you, Iran, but it's going to be in a more proxy fashion, right? So we're not interested in starting World War III with America over you. And Iran is like, all right, bro, I understand. That kind of bums me out, but okay, sure, I understand. And okay, so what's going to happen in the first few weeks of that war? Sea mines are going to be deployed to the Straits of Hormuz. That place, that sucker is going to be completely clogged up. It's going to be completely closed up, right? And off the 80 million barrels of oil that go on market every day, 20 million of them, 20 million, so that's one quarter, has to pass through the Straits of Hormuz to enter the global market. So that is not going to get on the market. And on my Substack, actually, one of my articles I wrote was Iran's ascension to great power status, right? And I basically linked to one of the seminal studies they did about a few years ago, where they did like a war game model. They used a bunch of partial derivative equations, which you don't really have to understand that much mathematics. All you really got to do is understand the qualitative assumptions. But according to them, the 6 months or so of that war, right, it will get you to the $200 plus for each barrel of oil mark very, very rapidly, right? And once you get to numbers like 400 or 500, industrial society is finished, basically. Because at that point, nothing works anymore. So if you've got trucks, tractor trailer combination, these sorts of things, and you're transporting goods and services back and forth, they can't run because the oil is too expensive. Trains won't run because, again, the oil is too expensive. Shipping doesn't run because the oil is too expensive, and so on and so forth. And the insurance rates don't work out either because, well, how are you going to insure against the fact that the Straits of Hormuz has sea mines in it? Nobody will want to pass through,
The
and so on and
Straits
so
of
forth.
Hormuz, the Bab al-Mandeb. It's the thing is, even if you decide, okay, we're going to roll up our sleeves, Uncle Sam and Lady Liberty are coming in here to do the American thing, and we're going to stomp these people into the ground. A fight with the, like, that means you're going to be having trouble. If we get involved in Yemen, you're going to be having trouble on the Red Sea for years. I mean, we will be involved in that land war to pacify them for years, for long, unsuccessful years. That's Yemen. You know, we're not talking Russia, China, or Iran here. This is just Yemen, Iran, Gulf of Hor Straits of Hormuz. Like you just pointed out, they're going to be tied up for months while shipping costs rise, availability. The complex system that is the world economy is going to have an enormous monkey wrench thrown into it until the war is over and the area is safe again. So it's like a war isn't even really an option. A war exacerbates the underlying issue until such time as it's won. You're not going to win a war with Yemen or a war with Iran in less than months, likely years, if you win. And during that time, shipping is screwed.
And I have every reason to believe that America cannot win that war because it does not have the years or the months that you are talking about. Because, like I said, within 6 months, if we get to $400 oil, that's basically it, right? Now, if you live in a society like Bangladesh, or if you live in a society like Pakistan, and you hear on a grapevine, oh, industrial society collapsed. Well, gee, that's awful, right? And so if you're in the big cities, you're going to be affected, obviously. But if you're out in the rural countryside and you hear this stuff, you're like, what do you mean industrial society collapsed? Look at me. I got all my agriculture and I got all my food, right? So that's basically the situation that's going to happen. But no, the I
Yeah,
feel sorry
not
for the
to mention
Americans.
destabilizing everybody around the region. I mean, American foreign policy never figured out that it's like playing Jenga. You can't just jump into one area. We're going to, you know, freedom and democratize it, and we're going to, and it's not going to have blowback with everybody around them.
Precisely,
We
yeah.
never got that very, very simple fact. I mean, American diplomacy is like, you know, the old joke, like, you know, German humor and British cooking. I mean, we don't do foreign policy well.
Yeah, it's not a like Americans are not diplomats. They're more like emissaries for the empire. So you send the guy over, and the guy gives you a big fat lecture, and then he tells you, here are our demands, and you're expected to enact them, basically. That's basically what the American emissary of the empire does. So no, I totally agree. And like I was saying, right, it's a very sticky situation. I would be actually quite flabbergasted if they decided to go to war with Iran and literally destroy themselves in doing so, right? Because Iran's going to come out of this damaged, but they'll be fine, right? I know that country relatively well, in the sense that there's a lot of folks there who are basically like the 1920s, 1930s Americans, in the sense that they can grow their own food. They've got like survival skills and what have you, which many Americans don't.
We
And, you know,
can't
if
do
industrial.
anything worse than what the Mongols did. You know, I
Precisely.
mean, it's sort of like you, when you have, that's one of the big problems for America. We don't have anything in our mythology that's like Stalingrad, that's like the Mongols, like basically slaughtering Persia. You know, we don't have a situation in our history, unless you're an American from the American South, where, you know, we went to war, we came, we saw, we got conquered.
And Andre Martianov says it best. He's like, at this moment in time, there's no American alive in any military capacity, serving in any military capacity, who has fought for his country on its own home soil, right? For them, war is a very, very abstract thing. It's like, okay, well, we are here in America, and then two oceans away, that's where the war is taking place, right? Whereas, like you were saying, good sir, like in the Soviet Union, when the war happened, right? The war happened in the sense that, okay, it's literally right next door. And oh, by the way, guys, if we fudge up the logistics chain over here, they're going to be in Moscow and we're going to be basically destroyed, right? So existential fighting, right? It's a saying which, you know, what was that? Like, obviously, it's a cliche, but what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. That's sort of true in this situation, not quite, but, you know, it's one of those things where Americans don't understand what real war is, like Andrei Martyanov says, in the sense that they seem to think that they're always going to not be affected by it, right? It's always going to be two oceans away, Nothing's going to get damaged. You know, okay, sure, a bunch of military families will weep for a few months or years, right? But, you know, that's their saying, oh, what about us? Oh, we'll just be going to our grocery store, doing our thing, doing our normal rounds. Nothing will happen, right? So, and, you know, they don't understand what it is they're about to walk into. And like I said, I feel sorry for them. But ultimately, if you support the Empire of Lies, at some point, there's going to be blowback. And I think we're fast approaching that point, unfortunately.
I
So.
don't think Americans didn't really understand to what extent American prosperity was based on squeezing resources from countries all over the world. I don't, Americans didn't, a lot of Americans still don't get that, like, you know, we have this standard of living because we have an empire. You know, our best case is we do like the British did. We gently unwind. I mean, definitely there was a drop in the British standard of living, but they didn't wind up having going down like the Roman Empire did. We it doesn't look like we're the British were smart enough to see the writing on the wall and realize, okay, this is unsustainable. The French were smart enough to realize that. We kind of did a different version, a less blatant version of colonialism, and we're finding that one didn't work any better than like the original version did.
Yeah, no, it's And honestly, it's gotten to the point where most likely the only thing that would wisen up the Americans is if, unfortunately, right, like we started off this conversation with sub-state actors. I think and you know, I don't want to call this a best case scenario, but given the fact that the other alternatives involve hundreds of millions and billions dead via nuclear Armageddon and red blood-soaked hellscape, right? I would call this a better case scenario, right? What I'm about to say, in the sense that you have multiple sub-state actors detonating multiple suitcase nukes all across the major American cities and Western cities, and the Americans can't do anything about it. They just lose a lot of people, and everyone is very, very angry. They're like, okay, look, we have this mighty military with all this sea lift, all this airlift. Go over to those, you know, goat herder, desert herder, whatever, right? They'll use one of those adjectives. Destroy them. You know, we want revenge. And then the politicians are going to be like, guys, we don't have sea lift and airlift from that era anymore. And oh, by the way, nobody in West Asia wants to give us basing or access or anything because we just murdered 30,000 plus Palestinians, right? We helped the Israelis do that. And oh, guys, by the way, we can't get basing, we can't get access. We had all these dirty nuke attacks all across America and Canada. And oh, by the way, while this is happening, the banks have gone belly up. So I honestly think that even though that is a very, very doomful, gloomy, and despairing situation, that is right now, at present, that is the best case scenario for how the American Empire implodes. The other way it implodes, that's actually far more despairing, gloomy, and doomful.
No, I mean, I think you're right. It would be, we have to acknowledge we're no longer, we're overextended. You know, we're at the point, like when the Roman Empire got so big, they could no longer handle it. It starts crumbling at the margins. What we need to do, you know, is we need to pull up the old terminus. We need to say, okay, we are no longer the world's policeman because we can't be the world's policeman. You know, we don't have the resource. It's going to be a multipolar world. You know, at least if you're an American diplomat, at least acknowledge it to yourself, even if you know you have to say something else.
Yeah,
You know, but
precisely.
it's like just acknowledge it's going to be a multipolar world. America is no longer, you know, we're no longer the head country in charge, you know, insofar as we ever
Precisely.
really were. I think we thought we had more power than we ever did. When I study papal history, the first thing the popes learned when they actually got absolute power is they learned how little power you actually get with absolute power. You know, you have to negotiate, you have to work with people, you have to make bargains. Sometimes you have to make bargains you don't like. We never understood that. We assumed, you know, we're America. We were like, you know, Homelander from The Boys. We are unstoppable and we will do whatever we want, whenever we want. And if anybody doesn't like it, we'll squash them. And we can't do that anymore.
Yeah, precisely, precisely. Compromise is not in the American vocabulary. It just doesn't exist. It's like, we Americans show up there and things happen, stuff happens, break stuff, break shit, whatever they want to say, and then stuff happens, right? So, no, but I think you're correct, good sir. I think eventually the Americans will have to learn to live with other people and to work with each other, work with other people rather. And do all this stuff. Unfortunately, I think it's not going to happen until you have something awful like that happen, right? So, and if they come to that realization that, okay, you know what? It's a multipolar world. We have to work with people. There's nothing wrong with being a normal country like the rest of the world. We've got all these resources. We've got access to an entire continent full of resources. We can have it good, right? But I don't think that realization is going to come unless there's like catastrophic defeat, like the thing I just described.
We have to
But
have that experience of getting ground into the dirt. Rome didn't have it for centuries. Then they got a little overextended. Then, as things started crumbling, I keep getting back to the Roman Empire because that's exactly where we are. We made the same mistakes. We got too big, we got too demanding. The structures we used to maintain that empire got too expensive. That happened in Rome. You need big bureaucracies to run empires, and the bigger the empire, the bigger the bureaucracy you've got to get. And that all sucks up money and it sucks up ingenuity. And we wind up with this sclerotic empire. Maybe we get lucky and we have somebody like a Diocletian who pulls something together and you keep something that looks like America limping together for another century or so. That would be the, best bet maybe. But I don't see the American Empire is past tense at this point. It's starting to smell, just nobody has dug the grave yet.
And if we're going to be using the Roman Empire comparison, right? Already the barbarians, in which case, in this case, rather, it would be the cartels and the gangs and what have you, they've already breached the interior. So America's situation is actually worse than the Roman Empire's in the sense that at least the Romans held them out, and the city gates, right, were over there, and then the barbarians sought to breach it to sack Rome, right? But the barbarians are already inside and the cities are already being sacked. And I think because the cartels have all the different advantages and boons of sub-state actors in the sense that they salvage technology, they indigenously make their own weaponry, and so on and so forth. Are you familiar, good sir, with the Red Corridor?
What do you mean by Red Corridor? Let's.
The Red Corridor is an informal network in India. It still kind of exists. The Indian government says that it's been taken care of. But if you type into Wikipedia or any of these places, Red Corridor, you'll understand what I'm talking about. So it's a hotspot of, all right, let me actually, I'm just gonna read this
Okay,
directly from
the
Wikipedia.
contiguous from India's border with Nepal to the uttermost, northernmost fringes of Tamil Nadu. Okay, Naxalite Maoist stuff. Okay, yeah, which what that says with ethnic tensions.
No, but the reason I bring up the Red Corridor is because I am 1000% sure, 1000% sure that there is something similar in America, except it's not Naxalites and Maoists, right? That's an Indian thing, right? It is rather all these different cartel networks and all these different criminal gangs and stuff. There's probably a sleeping Red Corridor in America, right? And they're just waiting for the signal. And when the signal happens, it's probably, when I say signal, I'm talking about a sequence of events, right? They're waiting for a sequence of events to happen. And once that happens, right, they're going to activate basically. And the activation sequence will be basically lots of chaos everywhere, lots of mosquito bite attacks in the sense that, most American cities do not have enough cops. Relative to the population, right? The ratio, I believe, the minimum ratio for viability is 500 to 1. Most American cities don't have it. So it's going to be lots of mosquito bites. They're going to overwhelm all the services. So police, fire, ambulance. And once they're overwhelmed, then you go for the kill, basically. Then you attack the command centers in these places and you take them over. So that's basically what's going to happen. And in the Red Corridor, right, this is basically what they used to do as well, the Naxalites and the Maoists, right? And given the porous nature of the border, I'm even more sure that this is, we're very close to that signal.
I mean,
And what was happening in Haiti, for example. Oh, go ahead, go ahead, go ahead.
large chunks of the American Southwest were part of Mexico. I mean, there's a large Mexican population. That was disputed territory. I mean, we had a war over it as little as 150 years ago. So, I mean, there are definitely the cartels are the warlords you see in like early Dark Ages, late stage Roman Empire stuff. I mean, they've served the exact same function. In this case, they happen to be remarkably well funded and have extremely good, have weapons comparable to anything any army that's going to go up against them has.
Precisely, precisely. And the thing is, right? The thing is, it's gotten to the point where I think people have realized this fact as well, in the sense that the criminal elements, the gangs, the cartels, right? They have all this weaponry and stuff, and we can't really depend on the government anymore, right? We have to, because, people might call it paranoia, but I think this is one of those situations where the paranoia is justified. Because, the many Americans who live out in the, the boonies, shall we say, right, are like flyover country. Some people like to disparagingly say, right? But they've basically realized that, hey, when these guys go for the kill shot, the government's not going to show up to protect us, basically. So we have to basically arm ourselves and do our thing. And so this has obviously there's a good side to it in the sense that it teaches you more life skills, you get well prepared, you get along with your community more, and you kind of get people together, organized and what have you. But the bad side of it is that people who have psychological issues and they're not good with like groups and teams and whatnot, they become more paranoid, right? And they buy up all this weapons and stuff, and this actually exacerbates tensions and what have you. So I'm already seeing that in American society, right? Everyone sort of knows that we're kind of in the waning days, like you said, Gustav, of the Roman Empire. Obviously, people want something similar to like the people who know that the collapse is going to happen 1,000%. They're like, okay, can it at least be something relatively peaceful, like the Soviet collapse? Can it be something like that, right? But every indication is that no, it's not, because like these guys in these criminal gangs and whatnot, they have a red corridor style network, and it is going to activate. So. And if anything, I think if I had to make a guess, most likely the opening attack will be a massive cyber attack. It will be like a massive cyber attack that will make everyone blind, basically. And so, for example, Chicago police will not know what's happening in the entire city. And then there'll be all these like mosquito bite attacks all across Chicago. And then everyone will try their best using analog methods, right, to respond to fire emergencies, ambulance, police, et cetera, and then the kill shot happens basically, and then they take over all the different like centers. So that's, I think, that's what they're trying to replicate, like these criminal elements. And like what happened in Haiti recently, where like these criminal gangs and whatnot took over the country, right? And obviously people say that, okay, these are not criminal gangs, these are vigilantes, and they're fighting the corrupt system, et cetera. Some people have nice things to say about them. Fair enough. Okay, fair enough. But for most other people, they look like criminal gangs from the outside. So that's why I'm calling them criminal gangs, right? There could be a vigilante element to it as well. But what I'm trying to say is that right now, the plan, good sir, I don't know if you saw this, but right now, the plan that the Americans have, the so-called plan, is that, yeah, we're going to stock them up in Gitmo, right? And I just laughed when I saw that. I'm like, okay, so you're gonna take a bunch of Haitians, right? And there are cannibals in some of these gangs. There are literal cannibals in there, right? Not all of them are, obviously,
Yeah.
right? Not
I
all
mean,
of them
if you
are,
think
but
about it, it's a really, you want to intimidate the hell out of your enemies. I mean, eating an enemy you just roasted is a pretty good way to send a message to people. Do, like, I take me seriously. I mean, it's also the thing with Haiti is you've always had it's a mountainous island. Transport, interior transport is challenging. You have small village communities. You have secret societies that people take care of each other. What happened is the government couldn't stop the criminals. A lot of these people are fighting the criminals. Some of these people were criminals themselves. It's like the pirate wars in the 18th century. Are you a pirate or a privateer? Well, that
Pretty
depends
much.
on whether you
Pretty much.
recognize my papers. It's here. It's the same thing. It's just what you're seeing is the government, which always had a tenuous rule over Haiti, just now had none because, like, Haitians have just been ruled by incompetence for decades now. Papa Doc Duvalier gets the bad thing. Oh, he was a terrible tyrant. It's like, well, Papa Doc Duvalier got rid of yaws in the country. Papa Doc Duvalier was helped ensure poor people got fed more under Duvalier than they did under a lot of people before him. It's
He
that's
was a
something
vigilante, basically.
Americans don't, yeah, Americans
He was a
don't
vigilante.
get this. Well, you know, he's a tyrant, therefore he's got to be a bad person, and everybody around him lives in terror. They can't account for somebody like a Viktor Orban. You know, he doesn't vote the way
Exactly,
we do.
exactly.
You know, he's a fascist, but his people seem to love him.
No, people are complicated, right? And I'm 100% like I looked at his life and no Papa Doc, and the Haitians view the criminal gangs, at least many of them, as heroes because they do what the police are supposed to do. But because the Americans bribe everyone and because the Americans basically buy and pay for the leadership, they're basically corrupt as sin. And so these guys take up protection duties, these guys take up, okay, clean water initiatives, these type of things. That's what they do, right? But what I'm trying to say is that these are like rough dudes. These are really rough dudes. And they have some of them are like ex-cannibals, or they had like, you know, they used to have a gang past. And then Papa Doc's like, guys, let's not fight anymore. And now he's on their team. You know, so there's people like that. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm
There
trying to
are
say,
some really rough people up there. There's
And then you want to put
anytime
these
you
guys
get
into
to a
Gitmo.
mount, yeah, you're gonna come put them into Gitmo. You're
Gitmo, that's
going to
hilarious. I'm
go
like,
travel around the Haitian mountains, mountains that you only know from like a satellite map, fighting people who have lived there. I mean, who have been in those hills since their ancestors ran off a plantation and set up, you know, war camps there. You're going to go into those island, into those mountains, and you're going to take them out with land hand-to-hand combat. It's like, no, you won't. You're
Never
going
gonna
to get
happen.
slaughtered.
Never gonna happen. And you know the thing? I was thinking about this. This is basically like the plot of you're familiar with the good Sir Alexander McCree, right? From
Alexander.
Contemplations on the Tree of Woe.
Yes,
That
I
sort of
kind of,
stuff.
yeah, I know.
Yeah, okay,
That's
so his day job is game design, right? But he's got a superhero comic, right? And the plot of the superhero comic is that there's a dude who used to be a man-eater, like a cannibal, right? And he used to run American death squads in Iran. And he gets injected with drugs and he becomes like a supervillain, right? But he was basically in Gitmo and he did the prison break in Gitmo. So the
yeah.
reason I bring up the Haitian cannibals is because I was telling him that your comic book is about to be correct, right? So
Oh no.
they grab the Haitian cannibals or the ex-cannibals or the vigilantes. And they put them into Gitmo, and they organized a prison break. And what do they do? Well, you've got all this like military aircraft in Gitmo. So you grab the military aircraft, and what you do is you go to the trainer bases. So in Texas and Florida, there's all these bases, and they're just filled with cadets, right? There's like one or two higher up officers, but for the most part, it's just filled with like 19, 20, 21-year-old kids who are learning how to fly like the gunship helicopters and like the jets and stuff. So you go there, you spoof the radars because like Gitmo is filled with like these old grandpas who were like 10, 20 years ago, they were doing like cyber attacks and this kind of stuff. So you get their expertise, right? So you get on the aircraft, you go to these air bases, and you basically just seize control. Like, is that how America ends? Like, literally a bunch of Haitian gangsters take the stuff and they just like take over the bases. I was joking to him about it, but stranger things have happened, you know?
Yeah, it
It's like
would
one of
be
those things.
really, what do you do? I mean, it's America is, Israel's running into the problem America would run into. Nukes are a great, you know, saber rattling thing for intimidation. When do you use them? You can't really
You
use
can't,
them.
exactly.
That's, you know, I mean, Israel knows they drop a nuke on Gaza, they're a like pariah nation like North Korea. It's like, you know, never mind boycott, divestment, sanctions. You know, I mean, you guys will be blockaded and you're going to be invaded by everybody on every side of you.
Yeah, precisely. And the only thing nukes are good for is to deter someone from launching a first strike on you. That's what they're good for. And that's why you have them. But if the Israelis use a nuke on Gaza, number one, the radioactive cloud is going to blow into Tel Aviv and people are going to die from that. So that's a big no-no. So I'm like, I always ask people, like, okay, who are the, okay, the Israelis have 300 nukes or whatever the number is. Who on earth are they going to use it on? If they use it on, the Palestinians, well, there's going to be Israelis that die from the radioactive fallout in the cloud. Okay. So they can't use it on the Palestinians if they're rational. We're assuming they're rational. If they're not, then whatever, different story, right? So what do they use it on? Okay, so they use it on Syria. Okay, so in that case, what? Iran hits them with all their ballistic missiles and destroys them, right? Because Israel's a small country, right? Or what? They hit Iran. Okay, well, Iran does the same thing. It's a giant country. They're like, okay, you know what? We're just gonna launch all our conventional missiles, which have like what? A yield of like 1 ton, 1.5 ton, 2 tons, right? Doesn't sound like a lot, but if you have like hundreds of thousands of them, that's more than enough to destroy Israel, right? So like, who are they going to use it on? They can't use it. That's the thing, right? So it's a luxury product, right? It's a luxury product. They try to intimidate people. They're like, oh, we have nukes. Take us seriously.
Yes,
I'm like, nah, bro,
nukes
nah.
are also something. They remind me of things you see in late stage empire. The late stage empire starts to rely on, in Byzantium, it was, well, we've got Greek fire. We could set those, Saracen ships on fire when they come here. It's like, but making Greek fire was extremely expensive. It required multiple ingredients that they kept it secret because the last thing you wanted was other people getting Greek fire. And ultimately, they lost the recipe. But even with the recipe, people figured out, okay, this stuff is napalm. Well, if you have wet hides and you throw it over you, it'll stop the stuff from like burning on you. So it's like we have the Iron Dome, we have nukes, we have technology. That's how we're going to beat a superior army. The problem with technology, sooner or later, you gotta have boots on the ground.
Pretty much.
I mean, unless you've got robot soldiers, and then you need
Even
robot
then,
boots on the ground.
even then, even then, if you have robot soldiers, you need the silicon, you need all the minerals, you need the steel, you need to build the robots. And to build the robots, you need to invade 5 to 6 different African countries, and you have to grab their natural resources. Otherwise, you don't have a global, robot army. And to do that, you need sea lift and airlift, which you simply don't have right now. So the robot army at present is a fantasy. And even if you magically, like, let's say you had like a superhero with teleportation powers, and he just goes to all of these African countries and he just loots them from like all their minerals and steel and everything. Even then, after you make the robot army, you would not have the capacity to upkeep it because you would need a production and excavation of these minerals, this steel, and all this other stuff, which you simply don't have. So even then, that doesn't work, right? So Wonder Waffe, Wonder Weapons, these sorts of things, they're basically dead, DOA, dead on arrival.
Yeah, I mean they're big toys. They're spending money on rail guns and laser weapons and everything, and it's like, okay, even assuming you get these things, it's like hypersonic missiles. Okay, these are great. You're never gonna win a war with hypersonic missiles. Sooner or later, you're gonna have to put infantry on the ground to take the place you've just pulverized into oblivion.
Precisely,
I mean, it's
precisely.
just like we don't, Americans seem to have a problem understanding. I've seen people, yeah, well, if there was an American Revolution, we got nukes, you only got hunting rifles. It's like, yes, how well did that work out for the people who were fighting guys with hunting rifles in Afghanistan? Yeah, how about those Vietnamese rice farmers with hunting rifles? We sure showed them, huh? I mean, it's again, there's just so much an example of that. We're still thinking of war in big terms, and we're fighting people who are thinking of wars in little battle terms.
Yeah, small is the new big. Small is the new big. And I don't think the Americans are going to figure it out on time. The grift is too good. The grift is too good. The think tanks make too much money. Victoria Nuland was likely pushed out, but whoever replaces her, I think the guy who replaced her is like the guy who organized the so-called Afghanistan withdrawal. It's not a withdrawal, it's a retreat. Like, it's a retreat. It's a shameful, humiliating retreat, right? So he's the deputy, I believe, the deputy diplomat or whatever the position is called, deputy foreign secretary, I believe, right? So no, the grift is too good. They're not going to They're not going to learn on time, good sir. It's not going to happen, right?
No. I mean, I think the problem is we are ruled by people who are completely sheltered from the consequences of their rule, people who have bought into their own hopium and Kool-Aid, who sincerely believe, the arc of history bends towards justice. We are doing the right thing, and therefore, because our cause is just, it must win. It's like, well, but the world doesn't work that way. Only a very naive, very sheltered person would think the world is like ultimately a fair place and everything works out for good. You may notice it hasn't in 15,000 years.
Precisely. Yeah. No, the moral language in this stuff, right? And Andrei Martyanov speaks about it all the time in the sense that none of these people have the education necessary to command troops in battle, right? Whether it's military science education or like basic calculus skills of the sense that, okay, well, if you fire a missile with this trajectory, how long will it take to hit its target? And, what would be the other things you'd calculate there and so on and so forth. Like if you've got a literature degree or if you've got a history degree, by the way, folks, nothing wrong with those, right? We need people with those skill sets. But if that's your skill set, you should not be in charge of military affairs. Like you're not educated on these subjects, right? So, but that's basically what the Americans have to deal with now. They've got like, their diplomats have like English literature, Russian literature, yada, yada, yada. I'm like, bro, like you can't like understand military affairs if that's what your education is, right? Nothing wrong with that
Yeah,
education, right?
you need if you had an old school Victorian British education in history, you learned lots of useful things about military history. Unfortunately, the history you learn today tends to be like, and here's where the oppressive colonists came in, and this is how the poor oppressed people came out, where an empire is a bad thing. You learn about how horrible empires are, not how you keep hold and maintain them.
Precisely, precisely. And self-hatred that the elite and the leadership class of the West, and especially the United States, the self-hatred that they've developed, not only for their own civilization, but their wider society and the so-called like deplorables, right? The working men and women who make the country actually run, right? This self-hatred eventually will, and it's already beginning to, but it will basically make it so that their mindset will be like, okay, you know what? This ship is sinking. Let me just take a flight to New Zealand or something. Let me just get out of here, right? Because they have no reason to care about the country, right? And they'll be super like radical. They'll be like, okay, fire the missile, start World War III, all this other stuff. And people will be like, no, F you. Like, we're not gonna do that. That's crazy, right?
I mean,
So
it's people are starting. I remember like some billionaire was supposedly talking. He wanted to build like a private island, and they realized that, okay, in the case of a nuclear war, we're going to hold our private island for right up to the moment when our security team realizes there's nobody else in charge anymore. At which point, the men with the guns are going to rule the billionaires.
Yeah, because what else do they have? Like, because if they have family back at home and the nuclear apocalypse has started, right? Obviously, not everyone's going to die in nuclear war. That's actually a misconception people have, right? The death toll from nuclear war, even in the worst case scenario, is from 800 million to 2 billion, and there's 8 billion people on the planet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean,
I
just to
mean,
give
one of
people
the
an idea
things
of
that
what.
has scared me most about this is that what the worst case for me would be that we have a limited nuclear exchange somewhere along the line. Let's say Russia hits like French troops coming in with a small nuclear weapon when it was like, you were armed against Russia, we warned you. There's a lot of saber rattling, but no, but people finally decide, no, we're not going to get in a nuke slinging contest with Russia. And this now teaches people you can win wars with nuclear weapons. It also teaches people you can survive a nuclear war. That's a good thing. That's a bad thing. Those are both, I mean, it now makes I grew up in an age, you know, I came up during the days when we still had fallout shelters in the United States, duck and cover, and you know, people were really afraid of the end of the world coming from a nuclear blast. Nobody has really panicked in the United States about that stuff for decades now. If
Exactly,
we
exactly.
survive one, suddenly nuclear weapons become thinkable. You see what I'm saying? They
Yeah,
become like, and all of a sudden, nukes become just another thing that you use in your arsenal when you're contemplating a war, up to and including dirty bombs.
Chemical weapons have that status now, right? There used to be a time when we said, okay, no to chemical weapons, no to biological weapons, right? And in many ways, actually, chemical and biological weapons are more deadly than nukes in the sense that if you've got the right vector for the virus that you're spreading out, you can actually kill many more, right? But I definitely agree with you, good sir, in the sense that it's not that it's true that nuclear war is going to end humanity. It's not. It's false, right? It's going to be 2 billion dead, but then it's 6 billion are going to survive, right? The issue is, what kind of world does that create? Like you said, right? It creates a world where people realize, oh, you know what? Nukes are not a big deal, right? Oh, you know, 2 billion dead, oh, whatever, you know, it's just 2 billion dead. Well, you know, there'll be still 6 billion left. I'll be among the 6 billion, right?
Yeah, there's
So
2
if
billion
that's the
dead, but there's
mindset,
one person that won the war. And that's like, yeah, that mindset to me is like just that sets the stage for like, you know, decades of really, really high casualty conflicts.
And if we're talking about high casualties, that, you know, it's not the end of the conversation there. It would also be the fact that you've got the after effects, whether it's the genetic deformities, whether it's the nuclear disease and all that other stuff. And, you know, once the nuclear cat is out of the bag, then people are going to be like, okay, well, what about these high tech or low tech rather biological weapons, which basically cripple not just the enemy, but it basically makes sure that his next generations or what have you, are basically cripples as well, right? So people will be using that stuff more. So it's basically a bad place to be at, right? It's a bad place to be at. Certainly, you don't want to wish that for anyone, but the Americans are basically flirting with this world right now. They're basically flirting with it. I mean, that little Emperor Macron, and you know, I'm surprised that there hasn't been a coup in France yet, like just to stop that traitor from like doing what he's about to do. Because what he's about to do is he's about to do a beeline rush for Odessa, right? Which is at present, it's still owned by the Ukrainians. But basically, what he's trying to do is he's trying to put French troops in front of the Russian onslaught so that the Russians don't hit. Like, this guy is nuts. He's
Yeah,
literally
that
nuts.
means
He's
he's
willing to
basically
start.
trying to start a war. He's a NATO power. If you know it's hit there, like there's a yeah, he is trying to get other people. I mean, I don't know what Macron is thinking here. You know, it's not the
I think his
best
donors
thing to
just
do.
told him.
Yeah, I
I
mean,
think
the
his donors
best
just
thing to
told him that
do.
this is
Yeah,
what you do.
yeah.
Yeah, go
I
ahead,
mean,
go ahead,
it
go ahead.
has to be, but the best thing you do, the best thing for everybody concerned in Ukraine would be we start peace talks yesterday. We start a ceasefire. When it's done, okay, you know, Russia's got Crimea, Russia's got the Donbass, you know, they're there. We can't force them out. There's no more killing. You know, the best thing you could do in these situations is have a ceasefire and talk things down.
Precisely, precisely.
It's
Yeah, no, like
yeah.
they should have had a ceasefire, like you said, good sir, like yesterday. But the reason they're not going to is because the grift is so good, right? Right? The grift is so good, and all these guys are puppets, right? They're all puppets, right? Macron is not a real leader, he's a puppet, and he's like, you know what? My handler tells me that Project Ukraine is collapsing and I need to send French troops. So yes, sir, that's precisely what I'm gonna do, right? And then he like posts pictures of himself on Twitter, like doing some bag work. By the way, his form sucks, just letting you know. So he's doing bag work on Twitter, and he's like, it's not serious. He's not a serious leader. He's not a serious leader. He's not a serious person. And this guy wants to start nuclear war with Russia. I mean, honestly, I think the Russians are just going to use conventional strikes and just kill French troops. And if France says, okay, we have Article 5 protection, NATO is going to be like, number one, you don't, because it's an offensive army that you sent in there, right? So, and number two, by the way, Article 5 does not say what you think it does. All it says is the parties shall consult about the matter, right? So I'm actually more optimistic about this scenario than others, in the sense that I would be actually flabbergasted if this is how World War III is kicked off, because it is so unserious, right? Like, at least if World War III is going to kick off, at least let it be between America and the Russians, right? Not some pipsqueak chihuahua like France. Like, France is irrelevant on the global stage. It's been irrelevant for like forever, right? And people don't like to hear that, but that's simply the truth, in the sense that,
France is
okay, yeah,
going to
you have
lose. Yeah.
300 nukes. Yeah, you have
France is
300
going to
nukes,
wind
but
up
like,
getting its tail whooped if it gets involved in Ukraine. They're going to wind up losing the African franc, which they still make a lot of money off their former colonies selling them francs. They're
That's
going
their
to
main
lose
business,
stuff
basically.
like
Yeah.
that. You know, they're going to, as Africa starts moving more towards BRICS, they're going to lose that. You know, what are you going to do? Send the army that just got beat in Ukraine in to like take over an African country?
I mean, they're already retreating out of the Sahel, so I don't think they
Yeah.
want to repeat that again. So, no, it's not a serious country. This is what this is, and I'm gonna get in trouble for saying this, but the Europeans, obviously, they're atheistic people. I mean, there's some serious Christians in there. There's some serious. I should correct myself, but there's
Yeah.
some serious Christians left in Western Europe. But all the atheists in Europe should wake up every morning and thank their Lord and Savior, the United States of America, for all that they do for him every freaking day. And what I mean by that is most of the countries in the European Union, and actually, it is in general, most of the 193 countries of the world could not exist without American unipolar hegemony. And what I mean by that is, if you look at a country like Guyana, right? Guyana would just be annexed by the Venezuelans, right? And the Venezuelans and the Colombians would basically reform Gran Colombia or something. And then if you look at Taiwan, China would take it over. And then, you just go down the list, right? Most countries in the world would not exist if the Americans were not doing their thing, right? So in that sense, the Americans, even though they've got this big empire, Roman Empire style collapse is approaching and what have you, many people are going to miss Pax Americana, right? They're going to look back to the time when, oh, we used to have our own country, we used to have our own flag, and we used to hate on the Americans, but the Americans were the reason why there were 193 countries in the world rather than 51, right? So that's
The
the thing, right?
Brit,
And,
the English used to, the Britons used to, when Britain occupied the British Isles, they were constantly complaining about Roman rule, constantly squabbling with the Romans. The Romans left, and that like town culture collapses to chaos. And from then on, Europe looks back longingly on the good old days when Rome ruled things. It's like,
exactly,
bro,
yeah.
you hated them when they were here.
Same thing's gonna happen. Same thing's gonna happen when America implodes, basically. They're also gonna be like, America, please, please, America, take up our defense bill like you normally do. And then people are like, America doesn't exist anymore, guys. You're on your own. They're like, F, right? And so, like, like the Baltic Chihuahuas, right? By the way, this is the reason why I don't take nationalism seriously. Actually, let me correct myself. I don't take 20th century nationalism seriously. I think there's going to be a 21st century nationalism, but it's going to be a more positive force in the sense that you have pride for your people and your homeland and stuff, but you don't turn it into something which is like, oh, I'm anti X, Y, and Z people, right? And I'm going to turn that into a crusade. And just like in the 20th century, I'm going to become like a pariah, surrounded on all sides and destroyed. But no, the reason I don't take old school nationalism seriously is because it doesn't work, right? Like, if the Baltic Chihuahuas tomorrow said, you know what, this Russian minority we have, they are not citizens. We don't want them. You need to get out of our country because you don't speak Latvian, Lithuanian, Estonian, or whatever. You don't belong here, and yada, yada, yada. I mean, they're basically moving in that direction in the sense that they're denying these Russians their basic rights and stuff. But what do you think is going to happen to them? Like, as soon as they try something like that, this is what Ukraine was doing in the east of the country, right? But as soon as they try something like that, Russia is going to ground them to dust, right? And similar things are going to happen. Like, all these people in Europe, they're like, oh, we got to kick the Muslims out. Okay, well, what do you think is going to happen? Like, do you think there's not going to be a response? Do you really think? And by the way, like, these European countries, they're not even willing to spend money on defense. And they want to start this shit show where they start ethnically cleansing and committing outright genocide on people inside their borders. Like, do they not expect reprisal? Like, what are these people thinking? Right? Are they good? Like, are they serious people? Like, this is what I asked myself. Are these people serious people, or are they just like LARPing? And has it gotten to the point where the LARP is so bad that they don't realize how bad of the shit show they're in?
Yeah, oh no, a lot of these people don't. I mean, our professional managerial class doesn't take accountability for what it does. They don't ever feel the consequences of their actions. They're sheltered from them. This is like Versailles entertaining us. That's
Yeah,
we've got that.
exactly.
So, they can keep doing stupid things because, most of us in the real world, we have a mechanism that stops us from doing stupid things. It's consequences.
Precisely. Precisely. Yeah. I mean, I think so as well. And I think I mean, they don't suffer consequences for the most part, but they're beginning to in the realm of economics and these things. But they're also going to start having, like, like all this weaponry sent to Ukraine, right? The idea that Ukraine's going to win, like, everyone knows it's not a fantasy. When the Ukrainian state eventually implodes, maybe it's a few months from now, maybe it's a few years from now, I don't know, right? This is not my expertise area.
Those
But
weapons are going
once
to
that
be all
happens,
over the world market.
yeah, it's going to be all over the world market, and you're going to have these really angry, bitter, ultra-nationalist or nationalist Ukrainian men. They're going to be like, well, look, you promised us all this. You said X, Y, and Z. You said that we would beat the Russians if we just kept on throwing wave after wave of men, and you lied to us. So now we are going to make you pay. And how are we going to make you pay? Well, you know those anti-tank systems that you sent us? We're just going to tweak them a bit. We're going to modify them, and we're going to turn them into anti-air, right? So next time a European leader or a diplomat or what have you takes off on his jet or whatever, right? We're like going to be 3 miles away or something, or 3 kilometers away, rather. And then we're going to shoot it down from the sky. That's basically what we're going to do. And we're going to do it all across the continent, right? And this is the future they've chosen, right? And these are the same people who are like, yeah, we're going to kick the Muslims out. We're going to do all this, right? And oh, by the way, no consequences. Like, I'm like, bro, you are in no position to negotiate with us. You are in no position. You are in a lower bargaining position. You don't understand it yet, right? Because you've not felt the consequences yet. But if you just look at the chessboard from a 30,000 foot bird's eye view, this is what's going to happen, right? You've not figured it out yet, but this is the future you've chosen for yourself. When you allied yourself with the American Empire and you allied yourself with this whole Project Ukraine thing, this regime change nonsense, and all this other drivel, right? These are the problems you've decided to take on, right? And, if you're going to be an adult about it, you got to fess up and take the consequences, right? But like you said, good sir, like for them, consequences are like many, many weeks or months or years away, right? They don't like to think about them.
Yeah, it's like that's, I mean, I think unfortunately, it's another, we used to have, it's, we even see it, one of the problems with our manufacturing se sector, our factories used to be managed by people who had worked on the shop floor.
One thousand percent. One
That
thousand
was,
percent.
they were managing it. Now it's like, well, we have this secret skill called management, and I can manage a 7-Eleven as easily as I can manage a chip company as easily as I can manage a car factory. And it's like, no, you can't. That's like saying, do you think with managerial skills you could run an army? I mean, yeah, you can definitely help with supply lines and stuff. Do you know how to motivate men to kill and die for your cause?
No, you do not.
That's, you're missing stuff like this. I think the managerial state can't collapse fast enough for me.
Yeah, precisely. And money, ultimately, when it comes to military affairs, men will only go so far as mercenaries, right? They are not going to throw themselves on a grenade and take the L, right?
Yeah.
They're not going to martyr themselves for money. That doesn't work. So this idea that, human motivation and these sorts of things, we can sort of manage it and we can technocratically tweak it with like these sorts of things, right? It's not going to work out, right? So, and honestly, the Europeans don't have an army anyways right now. I mean, some of these countries, it's laughable, right? They do not have any ground contingent whatsoever. So they have to resort to mercenaries. And, mercenaries always go with the highest bidder. And yeah, that's basically what's going to happen, right? It's going to be low quality troops. It's going to be mercenaries. They're going to be bribed. Some of them are not even going to fight, and some of them are just going to run away from the field of battle. And the Europeans are left holding the bag, not just with regard to monetary costs and these other things, but they're going to have all these other consequences. So that's what you get for siding with Empire, I guess. So that's kind of like we've passed the first 25 years or so of the 21st century, but the next 75 years are going to be very interesting in the sense that small is the new big. You're going to have these sub-state actors become more and more powerful, and you're going to see like all these different like state entities start imploding very, very rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just you're going to we have like the Roman problem in spades. A lot of what happens when empires fall is the supply network gets so big and so complex that one little thing can happen. You know, you got a Bronze Age empire, well, that everything is running great until like your tin supplier goes dry. You know, we've got a situation where, you know, if the semiconductor industry stopped worldwide, it would be ye we would be feeling the blow for years. We'd be hobbling our networks together. Our internet capacities would be grossly diminished in a matter of like months. I mean, we can't replace a lot of this stuff. You know, we have stuff when our empire fades, with we get. How much American food, you know, our produce, a lot of it is shipped in from South America, from around the world. You're not going to be able to do that so much in a multipolar world, especially a multipolar world where you have wars going on between different parties.
It's tragic, but we've gotten to the point where, you know, I think the Americans have decided that, you know what, even though we know that the multipolar world is a reality and it's about to happen and we can't do anything about it, we're gonna go kicking and screaming out the door, right? We're gonna make it as difficult as possible, right, for it to be born. And that's unfortunate. I think America can have a very, very good standard of living. You know, you can have all this good stuff and what have you if you are a normal country, but sadly, I don't see it happening, right?
Lots of
So
arable land, lots of running water, lots of riverways and waterways to ship things through. You know, we had a really good highway network. We could rebuild that to some point. You know, it's just, yeah, gasoline's going to be more expensive. People, you're going to see more bus travel a lot. You're going to see less people owning cars. I think you're going to see it like that's just. A lot of the things we had in America were built in an age of abundant money and abundant oil. Those are no longer a given.
Yeah, certainly. But if America becomes the normal country, it can do stuff which it normally can't, in the sense that it can cooperate with China, it can do technology sharing with, you know, Russia on like satellites and these sorts of things. It can do lots of stuff, right? So there's room for optimism. But, you know, like I forget, it was Mark Sloboda, I believe, who basically said that the multipolar world is going to be stillborn, right? He takes a more doomy attitude than myself on this, right? I take a more optimistic attitude simply because I don't see any other way other than like nuclear hellscape, nuclear bonfires, and what have you, right? Because that's the only way you really stop the multipolar world order from taking shape, right? And I know a thing or two about the American elite in the sense that when I study their lives, I'm like, okay, these are just cowardly people, right? They don't have the balls or the cojones to do all this, right?
These are
They are
people who
more.
have never been put in. You know, these people have never led military. They haven't gone to military school like European aristocrats historically did. You know, they've gone to schools where they've never been in a fist fight in their lives.
Precisely, precisely, right? And so, because they are of that cowardly disposition, I basically don't see them launching the nukes. And even if they try to launch the nukes, given the fact that the Trident system and all these other things don't work, every time they try to test one of these things, because, you know, it's legacy technology, right? They were supposed to, I think the Minuteman Treaty, Americans were supposed to do an update on it in the 1990s, right? But then, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed and then the Gulf War happened and they got distracted by like all this other stuff. And so now every few years or so, they're like, oh yeah, we're gonna update it on this year, but we probably have to push it back. So they've been pushing it back over and over again. Now it's not been done yet. It's gonna be, I think the next year, next date they have is 2030, but it's unlikely even that's gonna happen. And in the meantime, what's happened is all the engineers and the people who made this stuff, they're all dead. And oh, by the way, the blueprints, the handwritten stuff, and the notes that they left behind, most of them cannot be deciphered. And oh, by the way, the people we've tried to train on this stuff with regard to, like, what do you call it? Modernizing this, like, 60, 70 plus year old technology. Yeah, they don't understand what it is they're doing. So it's probably not going to be like, if we go
Yeah,
super
basically our
optimistic.
nukes are, a lot of our nukes are kind of glorified, basically art installations in the desert.
Yeah, that's precisely what it is. It's like a walking nuclear disaster waiting to happen, which cannot launch. So that's where America's at. And when you tell people this, that, oh yeah, most of your nukes are not usable, they don't believe you. But then you send them the stuff, you're like, yeah, no. You guys cannot launch most of this stuff. That's just how it is. Suck it
Whereas
up,
I would
Buttercup.
hazard
Yeah.
a guess that most of the Russian stuff is still perfectly functional and they've kept it up reasonably
Yeah.
well. Yeah, I just
No,
had that
every
feeling.
time they
That
do a
was.
test, yeah, the way you notice is that every time they do a test, the test is roughly entirely successful, or there's like a partial failure every now and then. But every American test, like even the British test they did like a few months ago with the submarine launch, I think as it was trying to like calculate the flight path or something, it flipped the wrong way. I think it has to do with the fact that the composite materials inside the what do you call it? Inside the missile that they launched, it had basically expired or something, and so it kind of did like that weird like twirly maneuver, and it just like fell out of the sky. So no, the British tests fail. The French tests are still kind of successful from time to time, but they still fail. The American tests are a complete basket case. They always fail, right? And the way they always use their media machine is they're like, oh, it failed, but we got some nice data out of it. So it's not a full failure, right? So that's the
I
situation
mean,
at present.
yeah, no, it's the we don't, and like we said before, I think nukes became, because they were such a big part of the mid-20th century American consciousness, they became this huge, huge thing. In practice, there's, in practice, I can think of a bunch of situations where, okay, a small size nuclear weapon could be really useful. Okay, you've got a formation of ships coming in. Being able to take them out with two or three missiles is useful. But by and large, nukes don't have a lot of, nukes aren't worth the expense of creating them and the hassle you're going to have to deal with when you use them.
Yeah. Nukes are basically that kind of weapon. So we are at the 90-minute mark, good sir. Would you
This
like to
sounds good to
continue
me.
or?
Actually, why don't, because I am waiting on a delivery, why don't we call it at the 90-minute mark? I think we've had a really good discussion here, and I think let's end on a high note.
Yeah, let's end on a high note in the sense that, you know what? Perhaps incompetence and the fact that they can't even launch their nukes. And they can't even retaliate properly. Maybe incompetence is what implodes America rather than nuclear hellfire, right?
Oh,
So
absolutely. We're going to go down with a, we're not going down with a bang. We're going down with a whimper. That's, I hope.
all right. I mean,
Okay.
it's not what I normally do, because if you go on my Substack, I always end on a doomful note. But fair enough, good sir. I guess we'll end it over here. Maybe in part three we'll look at more worst case scenarios, and we'll be like, all right. Because we ended this one on a high note, we'll be like, all right, let's
Yeah,
look at
let's
all
look at
the
some gloomy, some bad things that could happen, because there's lots, always
All
lots of those.
right, all
But
right. Thank you, good
okay.
sir.
Thank you and take care.
Yeah, see ya.
See you. Bye.